This is a Pinball News production.
All right, well, the subject of my seminar today is about creativity and a little history of how pinball has changed since I first came to the industry, which was in 1979. I entered pinball at an era when it was the Wild West of creativity, so I was unbelievably lucky to have started when I did. You look at the classic pinball art from the 40s, 50s, 60s, there's a similar theme to what's happening in all those things. They're extremely friendly, there's rounded shapes, there's not the remotest hint of an offensive theme. These could go into the most fundamental Christian small towns across America and across the world and offend absolutely nobody. Then the 70s came. The 70s were the era of Dave Christensen at Bally, who had the capacity to offend nearly everyone with his projecting nipples and his Nazi symbolism and his gang bikers and all that stuff. Not only was it offensive, it also made people pay attention to pinball art for the first time. I worked for a silkscreen company called Advertising Posters starting in the 1970s, which was the original supplier of all pinball art for all the manufacturers, all four, in Chicago. We're talking Gottlieb, Stern, Williams, and Bally. Thank you. Well, somewhere around 71, 72, Bally started their own art department. I don't know the exact year.
It was the
70s. Okay. Well, the young president of the company was named Billy O'Donnell Jr. He had a school chum that he went to school with named Paul Ferris, who was Paul, a local watercolor artist and a high school teacher of something or other, and he hired Paul to be his art director and build an art department over at Bally, which started the very first in-house art department in pinball. Dave Christensen was a part of that, so was Greg Frères, so was Kevin O'Connor, some of those names you might recognize, and they transformed what pinball art could be about by introducing four-color process printing, which means for the very first time, paintings could go on back glasses, and Paul Ferris was the precursor, the initiator of that process with a game called Lost World, where he painted his fantasy barbarians and ladies and monsters and creatures, and it was a painting and not hand-cut silkscreen artwork, which is what had been forever before that. I joined the Advertising Posters art department, and I worked next door, in the next cubicle over, to the veteran they had there, a guy named Gordon Morrison. The great Gordon Morrison, who was the signature look of all Gottlieb games for 17 years before I came along. You recognize Gordon's style instantly. It has throwbacks to the great masters of the 1950s in his work. Once again, extremely inoffensive. And the titles of games were interchangeable and more or less meaningless to a large degree in the 70s. Yes, we had the classic themes of Americans at leisure doing leisure things. You could have bowling-themed games. You could have baseball-themed games. Games that always existed in some fashion that you just translated into pinball. There was a pre-existing game thing, a polo pinball game. Gordon would do these sorts of things, and he was unbelievably fast. And he was the signature look of Gottlieb art and Gottlieb games at the time. It was a conservative family, and they didn't like the way Bally did things. They thought Bally was going down the wrong track, but they were definitely competing with each other head-to-head. Well, something Paul Ferris initiated, much to his credit, was the idea that you wanted to get the designer of the game, the playfield designer, and the artist together in the same room. This hadn't even been done before, which is why it was so remarkable, and it reflects in the creativity that pinball had leading up to that time. When I was at Ad Poster, I was still part of the old school. The powers at Gottlieb wanted a new artist. They had had enough of 17 years of Gordon, and they wanted somebody else to help shape the look of their product for the years to come. They looked over all of us in the art department, well, all of us. They looked at my stuff, and they said, "We'll take him." And I went, "Oh, no." because Gottlieb games in the 70s were the most conservative, boring, uninteresting games for me, because I had been weaned on Flash and Gorgar and Stellar Wars and the kind of explosive things that Williams was doing right at that time. And I played Gottlieb games, and they were quiet and slow and somewhat complex, and I was like, ah, damn. And what it was a chance for me to come up with a new look. And the way the artwork was placed on games, the way the creativity of pinball happened in 1979, is a Whitewood would be delivered to my office with little numbers written for score values and sometimes whole paragraphs of rules. A paragraph of rule, as if you're in a dark bar working on beer number 7 and you're going to bend over and you're going to read a paragraph about what you're trying to do. Who did that? Who read those things? I couldn't believe how Gottlieb games were done back in those days. And I was handed these things, and I'm like, okay. But what I noticed around me is that we at Adposters did Stern games as well as Gottlieb games. Stern, in the 70s, was unbelievably imaginative in terms of what their artwork and the theme was about. In other words, there could be about literally anything. They just came up with a name, and they came up with some artwork to go with the name, and it meant nothing. The game didn't relate to the artwork in any way, shape, or form. Therefore, the title of my seminar is What's Fun About That? Well, it was certainly fun for us, the artists, but all a game had to do was be colorful and not about anything. All that changed when Steve Ritchie came up with a game called Black Knight, and it spoke for the first time. That was something that was going to change the face of pinball, thematically designed from that point forward. The next thing that happened some years later was the invention of the dot matrix display, which meant you now had animated graphics to reinforce not just what your score was, but what you were doing thematically and conceptually when you played a game. A pinball flying across a playfield and climbing a ramp or hitting a target or doing whatever it did before these days, in the 70s, just went dunk and hit it. And the most a game could do was respond with a sound effect and a score. So you played for pure score back in the old days of pinball. Modern pinball, many people play for hours without really paying attention to what the score is, because it's not why you play them. You play them because they offer other rewards to you. They offer emotional rewards, which are far more compelling to people who are looking for entertainment in a coin-op world than just what your high score might be. There's competitive shooters who are always going to want to have their initials up there reading out, and good for them. What about the rest of us who have no hope? What brings you back to playing a pinball game? All right. So just getting a little history and overview here before we move into the participation. I'm going to need you to unleash your imaginations a little bit, or my seminar is going to get real boring after a while. I entered this era of themes where they didn't have to make any difference at all. I looked at Stellar Wars, for instance, coming out of Williams, and I went, I can barely recognize that there's even spaceships in that. I think these triangular shapes might be rays, and I think that might be... I couldn't make heads or tails of Constantino Mitchell's artwork. At least Gorgar, I knew I had a demon doing something with a naked lady. I wasn't sure what, but it was like, well, that's intriguing right there. So they're all about intriguing artwork that you could draw your own conclusions about that had nothing to do with the experience of the game as you played it. It was about some kind of an image that was interesting to the artist at the time, but not necessarily to the general public. Sometimes they couldn't make heads or tails of it. I was a young artist, anxious to prove that I was hot shit in my 20s when I came to pinball. And I looked at the artwork around me and I went, this bores me. Gordon, who I didn't recognize how what a great artist he was until I was older, his artwork bored the crap out of me. I wanted something that was going to be disturbing and exciting and noticeable in a crowded environment with all those other images. So one of my first games was called Panthera, pretty much in that Paul Ferris theme of here's some sinuous panthers and a sexy babe, and why? What are they doing? What about the gameplay has anything to do with the girl or the panthers? Nothing. Like most games in that whole era. Well, I finally had a chance to do a secret project from AdPosters, because we had heard at AdPosters that Mike Stroll, the president, was getting a little tired of how good the Bally artwork was starting to look, and he only had two artists working for him, which was Constantino Mitchell and Tony Ramuni. I don't know if you guys recognize those names. And they were getting a little tired of the look of that artwork. So they were thinking maybe they might go back to having some of their artwork supplied by AdPosters. That's what came to me. And they said, all right, whoever's got some free time, not previously scheduled, come up with a concept, an idea that we could take over to Williams and see if we could win that account back, because they had lost it a few years ago. And I went, really? A Williams game? So I killed myself coming up with the strangest, most imaginative drawing I could possibly dream up. It was about absolutely nothing. There she is. This was the game I did for Williams while I was still advertising posters to try to win that account back. And I simply decided I was going to showcase my drawing skills, which obviously they weren't showing off in their work, and I was going to do it in the silkscreen fashion. This is 13 hand-drawn color separations done with a double zero rapidograph dot by dot. There's at least 900,000 little dots of color in this that I put down one by one with a pen going doink, doink. It was insanely difficult to make this. That being said, what's fun about that? What's this game about? When you walk up to a Barracuda game, it's like, well, okay. The objective of playing the game would be, I don't know. Can you grow more heads out of her face? What's going to go happen there? So I'm just saying, I was as guilty as anybody else in that era of making artwork that was essentially about nothing, that was about just creative, cool-looking, colorful artwork that just looked interesting in whatever location it was in, but it had nothing to do with an objective. It had nothing to do with an emotional connection with you guys, the players, the audience. How do we draw you in? That was something I was interested in from the very beginning. I've always been interested in entertainment. When you see a movie and you walk away with it and it sticks with you, why? Why does a movie stick with you? Why do you remember it? Yeah, I don't mind you. Go speak up. I'm interested in having you respond. It draws you in because... Exactly. You're emotionally invested in what happens to who? The characters in the story. In other words, you go to a movie like an action picture, lots of violence, lots of guns and car flips, and you're trying your best to really give a shit what happens to Steven Seagal, okay? But essentially nothing ever happens to Steven Seagal. He's invincible. You know that Jean-Claude Van Damme is going to spin backwards and kick people in the head in the air several times. But do you really worry about what happens to him? No. What draws you into a story is serious concern for the characters who are put in some kind of danger that you believe, and then you are traveling on their adventure with them to find out what happens. And that's where the term suspense comes from. I was interested in how do you inject suspense into pinball. There's plenty already going, is it going to go between my flippers? Is it going to drain? When it's bouncing on those outlanes going, stay, 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 and you're, stay, stay. Thank you. Return lane. Those are great moments of suspense that are natural to the sheer physical kinetics of the game. It's filled with them. That's why pinball, even without a theme, even if it's just rules, it has that gripping factor of drama to it because it's a ball that you can lose. So here you are trying to hang on to your ball, and while you're hanging on the ball, can you exert enough skill to achieve the objectives to get, number one, that extra ball, number two, that special, number three, that high score? You've got things in mind that you're trying to do. Great. Now we know what pinball is about in its basics in terms of its physicality. But it's not that emotional. What happened in the 90s, when I was in the flower of my career, is thanks to the technology of games introducing sound, voice, programmable circuitry, a lot of those ingenious little devices and things and claws and who knows, everything that you could do with a pinball that our engineers dreamed up. It was awesomely cool. But we also started to wrap them around a story where your rewards weren't about 500 points, 5,000 points. Until we reached, you know, today's era where, okay, there's a billion. And there's another billion. To the point where, like, okay, another billion. You got so many digits in your score that you literally don't even know what the number is, because it takes you a while to stare at it long enough to figure out what actual number is that, because it's 13, 14 digits long. Really? The score is really why you're playing that game? I think it has to do with the fact that the game can take on a personality. It can take on a personality that will provoke you, that'll offend you, it'll tease you, it'll make you laugh. Hopefully it might make you cry. It'll celebrate you when you lose. The ball drains. General Yagov in F-14. What a bastard that guy was. There's a reason why that wasn't everybody's favorite game. Is because he just laughed his head off when you lost the ball. And people are like, why? It didn't make you want to just reach right on in for that next quarter. Other games had a way of really entertaining the hell out of you. Remember the great voices in, let's say, Raul Julia in Adam's Family? Remember how he made you feel when you played Adam's Family, just hearing his voice? It had an uplifting zing to it. It made you feel good about it. So psychologically, you don't even notice the fact that you can't wait to get back to play a little bit more pinball with Raul.
Well, let's face it, you just want to do the mamushka.
You do. We all... Okay, those are things that developed as ideas about what pinball could be over time. And I was in the middle of that right at the time when it was being developed, and I cared about it a great deal. And so we had little encounters, because the people who designed these games was a little group of people of like four or five or six of us. That's it. They weren't giant committees. We had an artist, a sound engineer, programmer, the game designer. Sometimes the programmer and the game designer were the same guy. A mechanical engineer to help make the parts work. And that could be the whole team. That's us. Well, today, this is the team. You guys are the team. And we're going to come up with a game. You don't know what it's going to be about. But now that you've got the ideas of what makes you play pinball, what makes you keep coming back, what makes you develop an emotional bond, an affection for a game, because it's not just the shots. Sometimes shots are sweet, I agree. Sometimes there's some of those Steve Ritchie sweeping long things like this that whirl around and come right back to your flipper to the sweet spot that just fires up the other side. The first time he had a left-right pattern, Terminator 2. Anybody remember what Terminator 2, the first time you played that? Left ramp, fa-thoom, and it felt right here, right ramp, fa-thoom, left ramp, fa-thoom, and you get into this unbelievable pattern of going ramp climb, ramp climb, ramp climb. And when you're in the midst of one of those great Steve Ritchie patterns, your risk of losing the ball? Nada. You're flaying the patterns. It's not as like slamming into posts or knocking down targets, which can send the ball anywhere. You're in the midst of a pattern flow. So what are your rewards? Since there's no impact sound coming from a pattern flow, how do you tell the player that he feels good when it happens? Right. It got into the whole idea of sound effects and attaboys. An attaboy is exactly what it sounds like. You do something right in the game, and instead of just rewarding you with points, it kind of pats you on the shoulder and goes, "Atta boy, way to go." And who doesn't like encouragement when you do something right? Very emotional. Well, the contrast to the attaboy, of course, was the mocking response. "You call that a shot?" In other words, General Yagov was an extreme example of that, but a way of sort of like poking fun at you, like, that was pathetic. If you just drain the ball ahead of the ball save, of course, you feel wonderful that the ball is going to come back to you. But for a moment, you might not know. So let's have some fun with your expense when you don't know what the ball is coming back, and then, then it does. So those of us involved in game design are interested in that emotional choreography. Like this. I want it to be a roller coaster ride emotionally when you play a game. I want you to have an emotional investment in the achievement of those goals. Okay, moving from the past, when it was barely happening, to the last game I did, and one of the most fun ones I got a chance to do with Brian Eddy, which was this puppy right here, Attack from Mars. The focus on the objectives and themes in this game are extremely clear and complex. Earth is being invaded by Mars. What do they look like? They look like that. They're huge, they're powerful looking, they're menacing, they're unstoppable, and they're idiots. That really helps. Now, we wanted to do that from the very beginning. You know, Brian and I basically were the creative group on that and decided, okay, what are we going to do with Martians attacking? Because you have to have series of climbing sequences. In other words, after I had laid out the inserts on Terminator 2, Steve figured out, okay, the idea of the same shot meaning something different multiple times when you make it, like climbing a ramp, kind of came about from that. So stacking those inserts in a row and having climbing rewards for it came about from Terminator 2. The triangular insert light, bright red, that was programmable to say, shoot here now. Okay, you made that shot. Okay, now shoot this. Okay, now shoot this. Well, in all modesty, that was my idea. Because sometimes I had a hell of a time understanding how to play a pinball game. It's in the dark. I'm drinking beer. It's cloudy. There's stains all over the play field, and I'm looking at the thing going, how do I beat this? I don't want to just flip around and see how long I can keep the ball in play. I want to know, how do you play this game? Some of the rules in pinball are phenomenally complicated. And I was like, why? Who gets that? High-end players have no trouble figuring out, but I could never figure it out because I'm stupid and I'm lazy and I don't want to work that hard at playing pinball. I want it to be obvious to me. I want to know where to shoot next. I want to know what it's worth. I want to know what the reward is. If I got two things blinking at me, where's my extra ball? Where's my special? Where is it? How do I get that? And then after those, okay, how am I playing the game and having a good time doing it? Well, line them up in a row and put a pointer light on it so it can basically take the player and lean them around the game by the nose like this. And it worked wonders. People loved that kind of stuff. And then all the designers adopted the whole sort of like flashing red or orange arrow to tell you, okay, this is this now, and that's that now. Well, that allowed for a great deal more complexity thematically to go into the games, because now you could have each shot mean something multiple different times. Well, we have the Martians not just attacking Earth, they're attacking specific places. You get to save France, Germany, Italy, England, the US. And each time you're in a mode, the whole game changes and it starts talking to you in French accents or in German accents and responding to you to what's under attack specifically in cities inside those countries. And it just gives this rich texture to what you're doing when you're playing the game and making the same shots. But it's much more interesting over time. Okay, so the Martians. We could have made them into the silly, unbelievably annoying little Martians that came out of the movie the same year this came out. Remember Mars Attacks? Okay, based on the collectible trading cards from the 1960s. I collected those little puppies. They were awesome. Those trading cards were the goriest, most disgusting, bloody things that an 8-year-old could possibly get his hands on in the 1960s. We specifically were not going for that feel. We were thinking of the 1950s movies. We're thinking of The Silent Earth. I mean, name your classic film from the 50s, the whole 50s sensibility of paranoia about alien invasion, which corresponded with the communists, blah, 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 the whole thing. But we had to give it a 90s upgrade. Well, when we're developing Attack from Mars, the movie studio found out about it because our licenses get around out there, and their attorneys came after us, said Williams. You can't do that game because we're making a movie out of it and your theme is too similar. Well, the job fell on my lap to write a document for their attorneys explaining what the differences were between our theme and theirs, because I knew what theirs was. You know, 9-foot-tall giant Martians with biomechanical interiors, no spacesuits, no funny helmets, and they're not running around going, that would just like nails on a chalkboard to me. Didn't like those guys. So having made our Martians look gigantic and intimidating and powerful, of course, they had to be silly. Well, what were they going to sound like? Well, we didn't know. So we had a script made up of what kind of responses we wanted the Martians to make, and then I went into the sound booth at Williams where we record voices, and then I spent 3.5 hours yelling myself hoarse, being all the Martians in the game. So that's my voice yelling at you whenever the Martians are talking to you in the game. I want to get you to start thinking with this story and the creative backgrounds. It's like, what would you like to make a game about? Let's make a pinball game in here. Let's come up with a theme for it. We're going to do it as a group, and I'm going to write down some of the ideas we do about it. As we go through those ideas, we're going to have a whole group response as to what's fun about that. Because understanding what's fun and what's not is part of the art and science of game development and pinball in particular. I'll tell you a brief story to preface it before I put you on the spot. About 1983 in the Ballet Art Department, we had a little bit of a lull in the demand on the artists in there. And so our art director, Greg Freres, came up with an idea to spark our imaginations as artists. He came up with a mock video game. The concept of what Greg called the game was toasters and chainsaws. He just came up with it, I have no idea, but toasters and chainsaws, and we were all asked to do a mock art package for a game called Toasters and Chainsaws. So you can start with your imaginations, what does that look like? How do you play toasters and chainsaws? I wish I had the drawing with me at the time, but I had a super powerful muscular hero with a manic expression on his face, winging at the chainsaw, swinging through the air, and I had the sky full of winged, dove-winged toasters diving out of the sky at this guy with evil little smiles on their faces as they came down. What a surprise to me, about 8 years later, Apple came up with their screensaver of little winged toasters. After I had done my winged toasters on my thing, I was like, okay, some ideas are good universally, and flying toasters is one of them. So what I want you guys to do is don't make me throw an idiot theme at you, which is what Greg gave to us. What would you like to make a pinball game about? Okay, I want to start making a list here. We got Angry Birds.
Zombies.
Always a good idea.
You can always kill more zombies.
You can never kill enough zombies.
Exactly. How about Loch Ness Monster?
Loch Ness Monster? Okay. I love the theme of escape as a title. Well, of what are they doing?
You could be on a plane, you know, be the only person awake on a plane and having to land it, escaping from situations, escaping from, you know, imprisonment.
Or in real life, you're busy on a plane and you've just figured out that Al-Qaeda is in the cockpit and you've noticed on your cell phone the Twin Towers are just... That's a little bit too serious for this whole conversation. I'll steer away from 9/11.
Spiders.
Spiders. Let me add on to this little list over here, something I like a lot. Pardon my handwriting.
The other universal group you don't have up there as far as to destroy, you got zombies, but you don't have Nazis.
All right, here's how you're thinking so far, and you're on a good track. You're thinking about adversaries. Okay, and who deals with adversaries?
Heroes
do.
How about survivors?
Survivor, survival.
Survivor, I feel like there's a license thing. Too old.
You just touched on something very important for this discussion, and that is licenses. They've been around for a very long time. I did one as far back as 1980. I did a James Bond 007 game for Gottlieb. I don't like to bring it up very often because it was the ugliest thing I ever made. It was like my second game after Panthera as I got to do James Bond, and I thought it, you know, like looking back on it in my own career, I was like, oh God, I hope nobody finds out that I did that one. Not so much for the backlash, but for the play field, which was horrendously bad. I'll use it as an example of bad playfield art, if I ever bring an example of it, like how not to do playfield art, my own James Bond 007. Licenses, when I first came on board, in a big way, in the early 90s, were cool because we were really, really lucky that we had good ones. In other words, I was already reading Hollywood scripts until like midnight in my cubicle, hunting for the next cool thing that we could make into a great game. I mean, it's F-14, Tomcat very much could have been a Top Gun theme, but it wasn't, because we didn't know about it. Thanks to hiring Roger Sharp at Williams, we now had a conduit to Hollywood product in the pipeline coming down that we could potentially develop into games, keeping in mind that it took at least 8 to 9 months to make a pinball game from scratch. And you had to have that sort of lead time in order to buy into a license, because you want to release a licensed game, hopefully, at the time when it's still in the theater, so you're riding the coattails of several million dollars worth of advertising and marketing. That's why you want that marketing and advertising dollars being spent on your product that you didn't have to spend because the studio did. If you blow that window, if you come out 6 months after the movie with your game, you've really kind of dropped the ball. You've lost it. I mean, hopefully people will have name recognition and brand recognition, which is also very important to have brand recognition. But what if it was a highly forgettable dud of a movie? Then your license theme was pointless. It didn't really help you. And we've made in the pinball industry a whole lot of those, you know, dud movies made into pinball games. I was lucky I got to my first big one was Terminator 2. Holy cow, was that a hot license? And then my next license was Indiana Jones. So because they were so successful as licenses and people liked how I handled them, you know, I became the license guy. And they started coming to me with all these licenses. So I learned my lesson when Dennis Norman came to me with Demolition Man. And he said, Doug, I want to do Demolition Man, and I've never done a game with you before, and I think you're the artist to do it. So I read it, and I went, what's fun about that? Stupid movie. Stupid story. This is going to die in the box office. I can't believe they even talked Stallone into making it. Why do you want to do a Demolition Man? Well, Dennis hadn't done licenses before, and he wasn't the movie buff that I was, and he had no way of recognizing a good one from a bad one. He couldn't tell. He says, Doug, it's got Stallone in it, and it's got Sandra Bullock, and Wesley Snipes, and I think it'll be cool, and I think you should give it a chance. And I'm like, fine. Dennis is a friend. I really wanted to do good work for a friend, and so I started in on Demolition Man, and I would do my first half-size pencil sketch and send it off to the studio so I could get busy on the rest of the game, and it came back rejected with no explanation for why. Notice no art direction. Now, up until that point, I had been batting 1,000 working with motion picture licenses. I never had a bad feedback. I never had a problem. All the actors, producers, directors loved my stuff. And I was like, okay. On Demolition Man, rejected. So here's effort number two. And I really executed it well, and I made the actors' likenesses real tight and perfect. Sent that off. Rejected. 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 Rejected, 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 rejected. This is weeks of my time going by, rejection after rejection. I'm like, not even a note, not even a comment. Well, I've only got so much time to develop backglass art and get the backglass painting done, and I've got the whole rest of this game to get done. So finally, I'm in a panic, and I talk to Roger Sharp, and he goes, what gives? What's the problem here? What's going on? He does some phone calls, and finally gets the studio to tell us that Mr. Wesley Snipes, who plays the psychopathic, murdering monster character in this movie in the future, locked in cryo prison, who escapes and has to be put away by our hero, Sylvester Stallone, the super cop of the future, resurrected from the past because he's so tough in the 20th century that only he can possibly catch Wesley Snipes. And Wesley's got blonde hair and one blue eye, and he's this manic, crazy guy. So every single time I had done Wesley, I had portrayed him as his character in the movie. So you recognize what the movie's about. It's about Simon Phoenix and whatever Stallone's character was about. I don't even remember his name. Turns out that Wesley, in 92 and 93, was this up-and-coming, hopefully leading man movie star who was very interested in protecting his image. And he wanted to be a handsome, sexy leading man movie star, not a crazy person. And somehow he seemed to think that my pinball art was going to damage his career path. And so he just rejected out of hand every time he saw himself looking less than handsome and sexy and beautiful and with his head just as big as everybody else's in the scene. Thank you for sharing your agenda with me, Wesley. So now I knew I had to make his head just as big as Stallone's. Couldn't be smaller, even though he's not the star. And he had to be handsome and sexy looking and still be Simon Phoenix. Ugh. That was a total pain in the ass, and not one of my more successful backlash designs. In fact, I spent so much time fooling around with Wesley that I didn't get to actually paint the backlash. I art directed the excellent Linda Deal, who actually made the painting, but I had looked forward to illustrating in my own hand Sylvester Stallone's craggy face, dramatically lit for months in that process, because it would have been a sweet painting for me to execute. And I never got a chance to do it, because I had to move on and do the rest of the game. I can't remember why I started that story, but it was about licensing and some of the pitfalls you can run into when you work with a license. They can really slow your project down. They cannot necessarily help you when you've got a great one. When James Cameron is doing science fiction, like Avatar, hard to go wrong. If you can find a way to take a story as complex as what he tells and make a game out of it. In Terminator 2, we didn't even try. We didn't even know what the story was about because he didn't tell us. So we did a game that was basically just a lot of gray lines on a playfield and just a few plastic sheets here, and it became just about making the shots. We did fortunately talk Arnold into talking for us. On set, he agreed to do some custom speech for our game, and that made all the difference in the world to have it sound like Arnold when you play Terminator. Okay, vignettes, stories out of the way, licenses are tough to work with. They can potentially help you a lot, but if you just fall into the pitfall of thinking everything you do is going to be somebody else's story idea and somebody else's characters, you're really missing out on what you can do with a pinball game, like what we're going to do here today. We've got robots, angry birds, zombies, a Loch Ness monster, spiders and Nazis who might be involved in some fashion escaping from something, rescuing from something, Hopefully somebody will be a hero in the whole process. Any more ideas you might make a game out of?
Search and rescue.
Okay, well, that kind of goes along with rescue.
Competition.
Well, yes.
Discovery, like scientific discovery.
Really?
Yeah, like, you know, adventures out of space or discovering DNA or something. I don't know. It's, you know, whatever that scientific discovery might be.
I'm having some fun at your expense. Here's the problem with pinball and discovery. How many times can you rediscover the same thing and be thrilled by it? Discovery is about new. That's why it's called discovery. Pinball is about over and over and over.
Well, they didn't have that problem with, like, space shuttle. They always knew that was about, I guess, space adventure and discovery.
Well, space shuttle was about the idea of the shuttle being up there orbiting around, but as you played the game, what did you discover? Other than it can be hard. That's why I'm giving it down on the discovery process as something to accomplish, as an objective as you play it. That's where you want to get into the theme about is what engages you as a player to play the game, especially with modern capabilities of how richly you can make a theme come to life. I love that about pinball. I miss that about game design, is the passion I have for the amazing, cool thing you get to do next. What about now? And you accomplish that. What about now? And you accomplish that. If you can wrap that around a theme interesting enough to have consecutive, ongoing, and not necessarily, you know, ever-increasing rewards and challenges, then you have a great game. So, here's our list of, what do you want robots to do? How about, you want the robots to rescue the Nazis? Could happen.
I actually like that. Why not?
I'm all for having the robots rescue the Nazis. Do you want the Loch Ness Monster to escape from the angry birds? I mean, let's just start putting this stuff together. Robots rescue Nazis.
From the angry birds.
Angry birds could very much be one of the threats facing the Nazis. There's no question. We could certainly work the zombies in there because the robots are rescuing the Nazis from the zombies. And the Loch Ness Monster and spiders. Absolutely. There is nothing wrong with those ideas. Nothing. I'm not kidding. I'm saying those are valuable ideas to make a game out of that's really fun and cool. What makes you sympathize with the Nazis? Exactly. Okay, if you're going to rescue Nazis, the challenge in that is you need to care about them. They need to be sympathetic. In other words, when Nazis are in danger and you're in charge of the game, how hard are you going to work to rescue those guys? No, this is a good idea because of contrast here. I like the idea of rescuing Nazis. Because Nazis rescue the robots? That's harder because the robots might not emote that well.
Replace rescue with escape then.
Robots escape? Easy. We could actually do one of these right here.
You have to make the Nazis the bad guy.
No, you don't. In other words, they're such a cliche. The same way that deadly alien invaders from Mars or have to be sinister, horrifying things was such a cliche that we had a great time with it. What, attack from Mars? And then as you sympathize with the Martians. Those are the characters in the game that you care about. You care about the Martians.
You're still trying to kill
them, huh? Well, sure. But you're having so much fun doing it because of how annoyingly stupid they are. So I like the idea of how do you make the Nazis fun? Can they be annoying and stupid too? Hell yeah! We want some inept, incompetent, stupid, full of themselves, egotistically overblown Nazis that are in a terrible jam, and only your robots can save them. Now you're thinking like pinball designers. Really good ones, as opposed to mundane pinball designers. You've all experienced enough games that have themes that make you just go, so... more cars driving on the race track. Round and round and round and round. I mean, NASCAR is the most popular imaginable theme through a whole part of this country, which is just rednecks and fast cars driving around a circle. And it's not even demolition. What happens if no one crashes? What are you watching? It's like watching golf. He made the 18th hole in the... Lots of people watch golf. I'm not making fun of those people. I'm just saying, is that what you want to do when you play pinball? Because we had, you know, golfing themes in pinball in the past. Trying to make that next hole. Okay, and your reward for that was a few points and next hole. Okay, since we have a heart, we know we want some silly, goofy, egotistical Nazis who are, they're sort of MacGruber-like, I would say, where they need to feel that they are the masters, and of course they deserve to rule the world, and they're having one hell of a tough time doing it. Something is preventing the Nazis from being successful at being Nazis. That's where these guys come in. What are they going to do for us? I want some big global conceptual themes of what robots might do to help the Nazis out. Because that is where devices come in. When you're dealing with mechanical engineering on a playfield, you want to come up with, usually in every game that you do, some nifty kind of ball-moving device. What's it going to do? Remember... The atomic blaster. Well, that's... What does that mean in terms of...
When you blast your robot, it discovers...
Okay. But the robots are you. If you're rescuing the Nazis. And you get to be a robot, is what we're doing here.
How will build a spaceship to leave, transport them to safety?
Building things is tough in pinball. It's possible. But it's hard to get... emotionally involved and say, okay, here's a shot, now you've got the thruster. Here's the next shot, there's a directional vane. Your next shot is your computer navigational device. What I'm saying is, like, what's fun about that?
The robots can take care of the arch and nemesis, the angry birds, the spiders, because when you hit, you know, a certain place, spiders come out, or then the angry birds are coming around together, the robots can take care of those guys in the path of the Nazis running to their escape.
Okay, we're thinking cinematically, and that's a good idea. I want to think entertainingly. How about if the Nazis are suffering from such a loss of personal confidence that they really need a boost? You know, there's a whole armored division out there waiting for somebody to lead it into battle, and we just don't have anybody who thinks they can do it today. And what can the robots do for the field marshal who's got to lead those tanks in the battle? I say, let's have the robots... I'm sure I spelled that wrong. Give them a medal. In other words, what can you attach to a shot to give it meaning that you instantaneously grasp without any effort whatsoever? So that when you make the shot, little dot matrix goes, da-da, you pin a medal on the field marshal. And he just goes, and he's ready. And then you make another shot, and he gets an epaulette. Maybe another one, oh, here. And he gets this beautiful uniform. Remember how good those Nazi uniforms look? Remember those SS uniforms Hitler helped design? Holy cow, that was good-looking stuff. What a waste to have it on, you know, fascists. Good fashion design coming out of that whole 1930s, 40s era. That's why I got the idea of, you know, pinning the medal on there. Is okay, now you got enough confidence. So what happens when you climb up a few ramps and you dress the general up and all of a sudden you're ready for combat? The whole game goes into a mode, okay, to take on the zombies and the spiders. So you're inside a tiger tank, and you're pressing forward, and now here come the spiders who might be jumping up and down at you, and the zombies. And you get to whirl around, and it's like, boom! So every shot you make can be, watch a spider get aced, okay? Another shot you make is watching the next zombie blow into guts and stuff. So you're cheering for the Nazis. What a great idea! Why? Because you don't think about cheering for the Nazis. Therefore, it kind of sticks in your head, which is why I love the whole idea. Trying to figure, okay, now how are the robots, besides pinning medals on the field marshal, going to help the Nazis fight?
You're going to remove obstacles to help them escape through stuff?
Possibly, if we can find some sort of instantly entertaining and thematic way of removing an obstacle.
Or give them secret weapons.
Secret weapons are cool. Love it. In other words, it's the robots who are going to dream up the secret weapons, right? Because they're robots. I like that. Obtain secret weapons. You know, and you can have some real fun coming up with what those weapons are going to be. You know, the gas-powered high-speed daisy shooter. Plink, 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 plink. And the spiders just hate it. You know?
Like a spider gun.
Well, in other words, what are you going to...
Spider cannon.
But that actually shoots spiders.
Yeah, why not?
Well, we want to actually have the spiders as enemies that we can blow up as a satisfying thing.
Better than flamethrower.
You're thinking too realistically. I need you to get silly here. This is pinball, for Christ's sake. So my only objection to blow...
Bird
cannon can do it. My only objection to the zombies and the spiders as your opponents to blow up is they don't emote very well. It's hard to give personality to a zombie. In other words, they're not funny. And spiders are tough to make funny. I mean, you guys came up with them. I'm like, I'm working with you here. Hummingbirds. How about now we've got a personality. So the zombie hummingbirds they're on a mission to wipe out the Nazis because their fashion sense is awful. They've got a reason to hate the Nazis that have got nothing to do with a real live real world reason to hate Nazis. We don't want to even go there. So the thing is that when you hit a zombie hummingbird, or more importantly, when you miss one of those zombie hummingbirds, because the game's going to come into a mode when here they are, they're humming. Because you're ready for multi-ball, and you've got some big rewards in there, and things are coming on lock, and it's time to take on the hummingbirds. And you miss that last one. How does that hummingbird respond to you? You need some kind of reaction like that, because that's going to be the goad that says, oh yeah? In other words, this is what I want you, the players, to do when that hummingbird doesn't get hit, that last one, this hummingbird. This is your natural response. Why are you going to get that hummingbird right now? That's good game design. That's what you want, is you want this happening. You don't want, okay, ball drain. What's next? In other words, walk away from the game. If I'm designing that game, I want themes that say as soon as that last ball, number three or whatever it might be, goes down in between, I want to have a compelling reason for that player to say, oh yeah? Which has a lot to do with objectives almost obtained. Because if you just simply got the absolute high score on the game, and you've got specials racked up forever, and you've just beaten the shit out of it, you can walk away from the game with a feeling of satisfaction. Job well done. Let me see if I can do that to the next game. Bye-bye, punk. Beat ya. Much more often, that game is going to beat you. And it can leave you walking away from the game going, well, pfft, that's tough. That was a rugged experience. The outlanes are like wide open like this. It's set so mean. I'll never beat this game. So you're defeated. And you walk away going, why does anybody, who thought that was a fun thing? Or, what's fun about that? It's the almost got it that we're always aiming for when you're dealing with pinball design. It's the tease. It's the almost get. Which is why you have multiple objectives. It's why you rank them. Here's the easy shots. Then these. And there's your big fat prize up here. And you want players to climb this. But not on game one. You want them to get up to there. With half an hour worth of effort. Training, learning the shots, getting the thing down, realizing what the sequences are, finding out the tricks. If I slap the Nazi and then tie his tie on right, all of a sudden something that times out fast over someplace else stays on longer because I dressed him up well. Well, okay, that helps me get to that stage, which might be an extra ball. So this is how the design process works, is it's filled with these little teases. You want little hidden things. You want things that high-end players will discover in the game that the programmer has put in there that you didn't talk about on the little instruction card, but they're hidden in there. So they can blog about it, so they can text each other about it. That creates excitement. That makes people, really? I just found out a secret code inside Robots Rescue Nazis? Right now, you can't wait to get back to Robots Rescue Nazis and find out if you can work that secret code too. And get that hidden reward that's waiting in there. Our programmers used to love to put those little surprises in the game. Indiana Jones has got a bunch of them because it's very complex. Things that you almost never see except every once in a while when the right arrangement of elements happens and it's like, you get this cool thing. It could reward you with points. It could reward you with more time. It could reward you with an extra ball. All the ways that pinball can reward you, along with the sheer satisfaction of having discovered something amazingly rare and different that you can tell your friends about. How are we doing on time? 5 minutes, please. 5. We're doing great. What we need now, since you got the whole idea of our robots are rescuing the Nazis, you got an idea about how they go about firing up the Nazis to do what they're going to do, obtaining secret weapons is just one of a little list of things we could have them doing. What we need now to design our game, we need an orgasm in the game, a penultimate achievement that is the crowning glory of what you do. There can be actually several layers of that depending on how modern games are set up, but it's more than just special. That was good enough for the 50s and for the 60s, and then well into the 70s. But this is the 21st century, and we're not satisfied with special. Special's now lit. Make the shot. Cool. The knocker goes pop. And it's like, the next game, 3. Great. Yes, that's fun. But is it fun? No! You didn't just save the world from Martians being invaded and the whole world is happy and safe and celebrating. You... That's what we mean by a climax. In other words... The zombie hummingbirds need a queen. How about that? Where they all come from. The one who fertilizes or is fertilized. The one who lays all the eggs. Like the alien mother, okay? That can be what you finally have to face as the penultimate climax of the game. Field Marshal, whoever, will come up with a fun name for him later, has got to kill off the zombie hummingbird queen. How? What does he need to do it?
We jump through all your hoops to get the Nazis on the big red X in the spine forest of Madagascar or whatever, so that we can face the queen, the Loch Ness Monster, because everybody knows zombie hummingbirds come from the Loch Ness.
It could very well be that the only way to
program the damn robots. Well, we only have the Nazis there because they're going to be the she fields to save our asses.
Could be. What you need is an ingredient. This is a menu. We're like cooking French here. It could very well be that you've got, I don't know how to do with angry birds. The spider's not maybe helping, but maybe the only thing that can take out the zombie hummingbird queen is our Loch Ness Monster, which you have to find. And without the Loch Ness Monster in your goodie bag, or without it having been persuaded to join the Nazi cause. Sadly, it would be okay. You want to ride the Loch Ness Monster and take out the queen. But there is your solution thematically based on what we've got as ideas is to finally let the Loch Ness Monster take out the zombie hummingbird queen in a fashion that is so devastating, so horrifying, so satisfying when you finally do it that you can't wait to come back and experience that same victory again. So on that note, congratulations. You've done a great job of designing and coming up with robots. Rescue Nazis. Give yourselves a hand.